Hello everyone, welcome to Trolling with Logic. It is the 21st of April 2013. It's 4:30 p.m. here in the UK, 11:30 a.m. over in America. We are a regular skeptical, scientific, and anything else we feel like kind of podcast. And you are free to call in. You add the Skype contact, Trolling with Logic, to your Skype. Send me a little PM just with the gist of your question, and we'll add you in time. Also, just to remember that this show is getting recorded and uploaded to iTunes and YouTube. So by calling in, you do grant us permission to use your likeness. So, and if you can't get through today, you don't want to get through, or you're listening to this on the podcast, you have any further questions, the email is contact@trollingwithlogic.com. Without further ado, my esteemed co-host today, welcoming back, Kirch.
Hey guys.
And as always, Big Lundy.
Pleasure to be here as always.
So we'll just get straight into the show. As I well know, Lundy has been looking forward to this show for a very long time, ever since I announced it to him. So Lundy, take it away and introduce our guest, please.
It is my pleasure to introduce our guest today, professional philosopher, a senior lecturer at Heythrop College in the University of London, editor of the philosophical journal Think, fellow of the Royal Society of Arts and Commerce, author of many books and articles of philosophy, including A Refutation of Plantinga's Belief Come Desire argument, Evidence, Miracles, and the Existence of Jesus, Naturalism, Evolution, and True Belief, The Great Philosophers, An Introduction to 50 Great Thinkers of the Past and the Ideas that They've Introduced in History, and the book Philosophy Gym, a fantastic intro to philosophy book aimed towards adults. Ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Stephen Law. Welcome.
Hi. Hi, thanks for inviting me onto the program. I'm very pleased to be part of it.
Very pleased to have you here. Just as a little bit of background, the reason that I'm rather excited about this is I'm sort of like the resident philosophy guy on the panel, and everyone else, and this is not a shot at anybody, but everyone else is more science focused. They're focused on like biology, on physics, and all these kinds of things, and I appreciate that, and I don't mind that we have people on majoritively that are science-minded people, scientists, and like Vic Stenger, physicists, biologists, and all them kind of people, but we don't usually get philosophers on that often, and I was kind of excited when they announced you, because I had recently been introduced to your work, and I was rather blown away. I find it actually fairly... Not just comprehensive, but fairly easy to understand, even from sort of a lay perspective. You're very good at sort of putting your ideas in the context of allowing the general public to understand what you're trying to say. One of my favorite arguments that you put forward was the what was it again? I want to make sure I'm wording it right. The evil God challenge. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. That's what I called it. Yes.
Would you mind going ahead and explaining that one for everybody?
Yeah, sure. So it's just a way of presenting a very well-known objection to traditional theism. It's a kind of a unusual take on that old problem, the evidential problem of evil. So the evidential problem of evil, as I'm sure you all know, is the problem of problem for the theist that explaining why there's so much bad stuff in the universe, so much pain and suffering. If there was an all-powerful and supremely benevolent deity in charge, surely, whilst the world might contain some pain and suffering, it wouldn't contain the quite extraordinary amounts of pain and suffering that it does. Many theists acknowledge that this is a significant problem for them, that they certainly have some explaining to do. But very often they start to appeal to various strategies. They develop explanations, or theodicies as they call them, to account for the evil. And I personally find these strategies very unconvincing. So what I did was I found a way of turning the argument around so that the theists might come to look at what they're saying from a different angle. And so what I did was I suggested that we look instead at the hypothesis that the universe is the creation of a supremely powerful and evil being. call that the evil god hypothesis, if you like. Who believes that? And the answer, of course, is, well, no one really. No one takes that remotely seriously. It's an absurd god hypothesis. Why is it an absurd god hypothesis? Well, most people that I've asked this question of tend that their first response is, well, you know, look around you. Look, this is just not the kind of world that an evil god would create. It contains far too much goodness. There's, you know, far too much love, laughter, and rainbows for this to be the creation of a supremely powerful and malevolent deity. So they can see very often that, you know, it doesn't. There's a great deal of empirical evidence against the evil god hypothesis. And if that's true, and if it's reasonable to reject the evil god hypothesis on the basis of what we can see of the world around us, why isn't it reasonable then to reject the good god hypothesis on the basis of all of the evil, all of the terrible stuff that we see around us? Surely there's far too much of both good and evil for us to be able to entertain either of these particular god hypotheses, you know, take them at all seriously. Maybe there's some intelligence behind the universe, but it clearly isn't either of those two guys. So that's just to kind of set up the evil god challenge, the evil god hypothesis. And then we can go to a bit more detail, if you like. I'll explain exactly how it works in more detail.
Absolutely. Go ahead.
Okay, well, what those who believe in a good god tend to do when faced with the sheer quantity of pain and suffering is that they come up with various explanations for it. So, I mean, here's a very simple example that I'm sure you've come across. They might say, well, it's true that the universe contains things like war and murder, moral evils, but that's the price that God has to pay for certain very great goods. One of those goods is free will. God made us free individuals. He could have made us puppet beings, you know, on his strings that always did the kind thing, the generous thing. But then we wouldn't be free moral agents and we wouldn't be responsible for what we do. In order for moral goodness to exist in the world, good deeds done by free moral agents, you know, of their own volition, God has to cut the strings. And so now I'm free to do evil things too. And some of us do choose to do evil, and that's the price that the good God pays for nevertheless very great good of our being able to do good of our own volition. So the idea is that this is a better world than it would have been if we didn't have free will, and if it didn't then contain pain and suffering caused by us acting freely. It's still a better world because it now possesses moral goodness, which it would otherwise have lacked. So you can cook up that kind of explanation, for example. So here's what I do with the evil god hypothesis. I then show how you can run exactly the same explanation in defense of belief in an evil god. So if I say, oh, let's suppose there's an evil god, you'll probably say, but Stephen, there's so much good stuff in the universe. What about Mother Teresa wandering the slums of Calcutta and reducing suffering? Surely that's not the kind of thing an evil god would permit. He would clamp down on that kind of behavior straight away. He wants to maximize suffering, and he will prevent people from reducing suffering. Well, not necessarily, because an evil god will want moral evil to exist in the universe. Moral evil is, as any Christian will tell you, the very worst kind of evil that there is. And in order for moral evil to exist in the universe, God has to cut our strings. He could have made us beings that always did the cruel and despicable thing, but then we wouldn't be morally responsible for what we do, so he has to cut our strings. As a result, some of us then do evil of our own volition, and that makes the world far more evil than it would ever have been if we didn't have free will. But unfortunately, that gives Mother Teresa the opportunity to wander the slums of Calcutta reducing suffering. That's the price an evil god pays for the very great evil of moral evil existing in the universe. So you can see what I've done there. I've just taken a standard Christian theodicy or explanation for the evil that exists in the universe, and I've turned it round to explain why there's so much good in the universe, even if there exists some sort of evil deity. And once you've seen how you can flip the explanations in that way, you realise that actually most of the standard explanations that religious folk give in order to defend their god hypothesis and try and deal with the sheer quantity of evil that exists in the universe, most of those explanations can be flipped in much the same way. Sometimes they look a little bit less plausible when they're flipped around to defend belief in an evil god. Sometimes they look slightly more plausible when flipped around to defend belief in an evil god. And so the challenge really then becomes to explain, if you believe in a good god and you think that's not an unreasonable belief for you to hold, but you think that belief in an evil god is downright absurd, indeed you think that on the basis of what you can see of the world around you, the challenge really is to explain, well, why do you assign such very different positions on the scale of reasonableness, if you like, so far as these two god hypotheses are concerned? Why, if one is absurd, is the other one so much more reasonable? That's the challenge that I set up in the paper, the evil god challenge. I mean, by the way, if anyone wants to check out the paper, which is, as you say, it's a fairly accessible paper, you can download it for free from the journal Religious Studies. They have a PDF online, so you can get it. You can get it there very easily if you Google it.
Okay, Lundy.
There, sorry, there seems to be an argument already brewing in the chat room here. I believe we have a caller.
I was going to say, do you want to ask a few more questions?
Sure. One of the things that is being brought up in the chat room is if there is like no God and evil still exists in the world, then would it not be reasonable to presume that evil, as it is presented, is somewhat innately genetic? Is it's in the human, it's in humanity in some way to be somewhat evil, not solely evil, but somewhat evil. So would that be something that you would concede to, or would you have like a counter to that?
I'm not quite sure. It's supposed to be an objection to the point I've just made, because if it is, I'm not quite sure how the objection is supposed to run exactly.
I'm not quite sure if it's an objection to the argument itself, but it's more like I think it's an attempt at reductio ad absurdum, the idea of supposing, okay, let's say there isn't a god then. From whence comes evil then? Is it innately in?
Oh, right, yeah. There's a popular move which is made. This has got nothing particularly to do with my evil god challenge. It's just a kind of bog standard apologetic move that people learn to give when presented with the evidential problem of evil. And you can find a number of examples on the internet. It's particularly associated with William Lane Craig, Christian apologist. He often uses it in debates. In fact, he used it in a debate with me not very long ago. So the move goes like this. You say that in order for you, Mr. Atheist, to run the evidential problem of evil, you need to acknowledge that there is such a thing as evil. You wish to call these terrible things that people do to each other evil, and you want to say, and this is evidence against the existence of a good God. But it seems to me, says the theist at this point, that there cannot be good and evil without a God who functions as an objective standard of right and wrong, of good and bad, of morality. So even in order to set up the evidential problem of evil, you have to concede that God exists. So it's a kind of a reductio of the evidential problem of evil. It's an attempt to show that you're conceding that there is a God. It just so far as you even attempt to run the problem as an objection against theism. So possibly that is the point that's being made there. It's a very bog standard apologetic move. It's also no good. I'll explain why if you like. It won't
well,
work.
I would have you explain, but apparently the chat room is saying that no, this is not trying to say that a god exists. It's just asking the general question: where does evil originate in a godless universe?
Oh, well, it's there are two separate questions there. There's how is it possible for there to be evil or good in a godless universe? And of course, many theists will insist that it's not possible. So we could look at that question, or we could be looking at the question, well, whether or not you want to call it evil, you know, there's clearly a great deal of suffering and pain in the universe. That's entirely uncontroversial. And what's the explanation for that? And well, of course, there are perfectly obvious explanations for that, which you might give. We are living in a world that contains, you know, all sorts of things which are painful and which will kill us if we get close to them. And every now and then that happens, we suffer as a result. I mean, there's no mystery there as to why we suffer. So perhaps you're the person whose comments you're reading there wishes to talk about the problem of how there could even be good and evil in the godless universe. I can't hear you now.
Lundy, you're muted.
My bad. I clicked on and I thought I was unmuted. Unfortunately not.
Okay.
It's possible that what was essentially being asked was just the general meta-ethical question. Just from where does evil come from? Is it within us? What is evil in general? What would you classify an action as being evil? Because I remember, to specify a little bit better, I remember in your Hansa Sortsis debate, for instance, somebody brought up the free will thing. They said, well, we have free will, and that's why there's evil in the world. And you said, well, so free will is the cause of earthquakes, it's the cause of tsunamis, it's the cause of all these natural disasters, it's the cause of all that suffering. Is that what you're saying? And I kind of brought that up in the chat room, and they're saying, well, that natural disasters and diseases and all that, they're not evil, they're neutral. So then it becomes the question of what exactly is considered to be evil.
Oh, okay. Well, look, what's confusing the issue perhaps here is that the evidential problem of evil is probably quite misleadingly called the evidential problem of evil. And in fact, quite a lot of people prefer to call it something else. Sometimes it's called the problem of suffering, and that's possibly a less misleading title. So when people set up the evidential problem of evil, they actually just define evil as either moral evil, that's to say morally bad things that people do of their own volition, or so-called natural evils, which are, you know, natural disasters and diseases which cause great pain and suffering. It's claimed that these are, well, this is just how evil is defined for the purposes of the argument. So I just bought into that standard way of using the expression evil, which is the bog standard way of defining the term for the purposes of this argument. But you can run the argument without even introducing the concept of evil. You can ask, why is there so much suffering if there really exists a God who is all powerful and who is supremely compassionate? Why on earth would he create so much pain and suffering? Why would he allow so much pain and suffering? We don't have to buy into the vocabulary of evil and good at all in order to run this particular objection.
Okay.
Does that help at all?
We'll see when the chat, I suppose, updates a little bit. But for now, we'll divert that point and put a pin in it, because we do have a caller. Andrew from Ireland, is it?
It is.
All right. Welcome to
Wonderful.
The show.
Did you have a question for our guest?
I do. My question is, considering how far rationality has come, do you think we risk a regression back to a theocracy? And if so, what do you personally think would be the worst implications of such a thing?
I mean, clearly, we have, things have improved a great deal, particularly in, you know, the area where I live. I can express my atheistic views in public, and there are plenty of religious people who will work to defend my right to express them. You know, we are all secularists together to a very large extent now, religious people and non-religious people, and we respect each other's, you know, views, and at least to the extent that we're more than happy for them to be expressed in the public space. So that's all good. Do I fear that that might one day disappear? It's very difficult to make predictions. I do think that it's hard to... Well, this is what I think about religion, I suppose. This is why I think you need to keep tabs on religion. And I think that it has downsides to it. But I do think that there are good things about religion too, potentially. I think that, you know, you can make a case for saying that perhaps religion encourages good behaviour in a particular way that otherwise is rather difficult to encourage, perhaps something like that. It seems to me that religion is probably a catalyst, a powerful catalyst. So you can sprinkle it on an individual and their good traits might be magnified by sprinkling on a little bit of religious fairy dust, but actually also their bad traits can be magnified too by sprinkling on a little bit of religious fairy dust. So somebody who is a little bit misogynistic or a little bit cruel or a little bit of an authoritarian can become far more so. They can become quite a monster once religion has been sprinkled on them. So it functions as a catalyst. And it can have some good effects, I don't want to deny that, but it also can have some bad effects. I think that it's very difficult. I think that religion can tick along in the background fairly harmlessly, but that, like nuclear power, when it goes wrong, it can go spectacularly wrong in a highly unpredictable way. Something will happen that people just hadn't thought about, and suddenly religion can explode and can produce quite extraordinary bad effects in a very short period of time. And for that reason, then, I think we should keep tabs on it. And I certainly wouldn't rule out the possibility of that happening in the next 50 or 100 years, even in countries that are currently really rather secular. The world can change quite rapidly. It may be that things will change. I certainly don't think that religion will disappear from the face of the earth. I'm inclined to agree with the psychologist Justin Barrett, who's of the view that even if you could completely eradicate religion for a generation, it would still come back, because it's kind of hardwired into us to some extent. It's never going to go away. And if that's true, then I think we need to monitor it, make sure that the worst kinds of religion, the worst excesses of religion, don't suddenly explode upon us. Make sure we're prepared for that.
So would you say that, say, Dawkins's sort of ideal future where religion is sort of pushed into this corner of society where it's more considered a quaint hobby rather than a serious philosophical stance, you think that that's probably more of a pipe dream than anything that's realistic?
I'm not sure. I'm really not sure. Possibly that could happen. But I can't say I'm terrifically confident. No. I mean, it seems to me that religion is extraordinarily resilient. And you can put enormous effort into trying to suppress religious belief. And the minute that you reduce the pressure, it suddenly bounces back, and then some, as we found out in under the communist regimes, for example, which were very very unsympathetic to religion, tried to suppress it. The minute that the lid is taken off, suddenly it's back and with a vengeance. So I'm not sure we will ever get rid of religion. I don't think that religion is a force for evil in the world, particularly, but I think that it is potentially rather dangerous thing, and unscrupulous and selfish and bad people can certainly use it as a tool in very bad ways, and so we need to keep tabs on that. We need to make sure that people are aware of the downside to religion. In particular, I think it's very important that people are given some immunity to the kind of bullshit that religion and all sorts of other religious and non-religious belief systems can use to suck people in and hold them captive and turn them into the willing slaves of claptrap.
Speaking of bullshit, I just want to make a note for everybody who's watching. There is another book out by Dr. Stephen Law, Believing Bullshit. I did not mention that in my intro. Everybody, if you feel the need to, please go ahead and check that out.
Andrew, do you have any?
I just have one little point that came up after I'd asked to call in during the chat. When you made your point about Mother Teresa being such a lovely person,
yeah.
It started quite the argument in the chat because
yeah, yes, I have read
to say she has a checkered past, is to put it mildly.
Yeah, no, that was my tongue was slightly in my cheek. literary. Yeah. I have read Christopher Hitchens' book. I mean, I'm just not in a position to make a judgment about Mother Teresa, but I was, you know, suppose for the sake of argument that she went around producing suffering, which is actually something that Christopher Hitchens denies, isn't it? But supposing that was the case, why wouldn't an evil god come in and prevent that sort of behaviour? That was my point. Just using her as an illustration, whether or not accurate.
No, it's just that it popped into my head when you all started talking about bullshit, just that Penn and Teller episode about it.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
Which is actually a spectacular episode of the show, and I would recommend.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm a big fan.
Is that everything, Andrew?
That is. All right. Thank you very much for your time.
And thanks for the call.
Thank you for coming on.
Thanks for calling in. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye.
So I've been investigating as to what the disconnect is as far as the chat room and the current discussion about evil goes, and I think this is in part my fault because I was sort of engaging in my own sort of discussion in the chat room while I was sort of multitasking with you, and one of the things I brought up was the whole notion of earthquakes, tsunamis, natural disasters, diseases, all these things cause suffering. And it's not unreasonable to sort of equate suffering with a form of evil. And the objection here is, well, evil necessarily, at least by their definition, has to do with intent. So if a thing doesn't have agency, yeah, then it can't commit evil. So I think that's kind of my mistake on that.
Yeah, I guess that was what was going on. Yeah, that's just not how the word happens to be defined for the purposes of this argument. You know, you can use another word, it doesn't matter.
Right, so evil, for the purposes of your argument, does not need to be defined in the sense of agency. I would say, just as a sort of defense of the argument, you can correct me if this is sort of facile, but I would say that the reason that it can be sufficiently said that these natural disasters and such can be considered evil is because the argument is phrased in the context of a sort of governing supernatural being that is causing certain things to happen or has created things in a way in which events will play out. Therefore, there is intent behind the natural disasters and diseases and all that, because that was set up in some way by some sort of intelligence, either intentionally or no. The state of being, the state of affairs, as it were, sort of creates this effect of natural disasters, diseases, and all this suffering.
Yes, I can see where you're going with that. Is the the fact is that the word evil, it wasn't me that defined it this way for the purposes of this argument or this objection. It has a long history of being defined in such a way that, you know, there are two classes of evil. There are the so-called moral evils, which are the terrible things that free moral agents do to each other, killing and so on. And then there are the so-called natural evils, and they, you know, that would be pain and suffering caused by natural diseases and disasters and so on, whether or not, ultimately the product of some kind of deity or something like that, some kind of agent behind the scenes. And that's just how the word happens to have been defined. And it is kind of misleading, and people do get confused about what's really going on with this argument. As I say, you can set the argument up without even using the vocabulary of evil. It's just that the tradition is to use this particular vocabulary, so I've bought into it. But the downside to that is that people get a bit misled. So unfortunately, that's what's happened today. One of the objections, as I did mention, one of the objections that you get to the evidential problem of evil is, but look, in order for you, Mr. Atheist, to run the problem, you have to buy into the distinction between good and evil, and it just so happens that you can't have that distinction unless there is a God. So it's a kind of a self-defeating argument. But that's also to misunderstand the nature of the argument. What the person who runs the problem of evil is doing is that they're pointing out that the theist's position is seemingly self-undermining. It's the theist who believes in good and evil. I, as an atheist, don't have to. I could be a moral nihilist, for example, but I can still point out that, you know, you, Mr. Theist, you believe in good and evil, and indeed you consider things like pointless suffering to be evil. You call that a natural evil. Now, why is there so much natural evil if your good God exists? There's a tension there. On the face of it, we have very good evidence supplied by this natural evil against your God hypothesis. Now, if you're right to say that there's no good and evil without God, well, then I'll agree with you, perhaps. I can say, yes, all right, then there is no good and evil. But the fact is that this fear, this suffering, would certainly qualify as evil if your God exists. And so the fact is that it is good evidence against the existence of your God, whether or not it's true that you can't have good and evil without a God. It's beside the point. So there's no real problem. There's no real good objection there to the evidential problem of evil. But this particular move is very, very popular with Christian apologists, and it's often used by William Lane Craig in debates, for example. And if you look up "evil proves God," that phrase on Google, you will find examples of William Lane Craig, for example, and others using it in debates, including with me. So not a very good argument, but very, very popular with Christian apologists.
I remember actually watching that debate between you and William Lane Craig. I was actually a little astounded by his approach to the debate, because he gave his rebuttal, which was essentially appealing to, well, if you accept that evil exists, then you must accept that God exists, as per my moral argument. Yes. And then you came up and said, well, then I'm fine with dismissing the notion of evil, then we'll just go with suffering. Suffering exists, we'll say that. Now what? It still exists. You haven't really avoided the problem. And eventually he just sort of broke down and went, well, I'm just trying to get you to address my other argument instead of focusing on the moral one. You're like, no, we're just going to focus on this one. So I thought that was a really interesting debate, because Craig almost sort of like conceded, I don't really have a rebuttal prepared for that. If you wouldn't mind approaching Kalam or something along those lines, I can debate those better.
Yeah, his response, I mean, I think there was a little bit of a response to the evidential problem of evil, to be fair to Craig, but it went past so quickly that I actually missed it the first time round. It was only actually when we got to the Q&A at the end that I even noticed that he had any kind of response to the problem of evil at all, and he was really just playing as kind of a skeptical card. At that point, appealing to what's sometimes called skeptical theism. Actually, William Craig wouldn't like that particular label, but he goes with something along those lines. But yeah, I really enjoyed that debate, and I quite like, in a way, I quite like Bill Craig. I mean, you know, he cares about what he's doing, and he's passionate about it, and he has come up with one or two interesting philosophical arguments. I wouldn't want to deny that he is certainly a philosopher. And, you know, he seems like a nice guy, generally. I think that so powerful is his concern with saving souls, however, mine included, that sometimes he's so focused on that, but he doesn't mind too much by what route he gets there. And so he will use an argument that perhaps even he himself realizes is a bit ropey, but it doesn't matter just so long as he wins round opinion. It's a debate, after all. It's not an academic exercise. He sees it as a debate format, and that in a debate, you know, your aim is to win the debate by whatever rhetorical device you can lay your hands on. Whether it's a good argument or whether it really looks like a good argument, doesn't really matter. And that I'm less comfortable with. I mean, I think that's what I'm less impressed by when it comes to someone like Bill Craig, because I want to believe what's true. And I go into those debates, you know, genuinely wanting to know what's true. That's the bottom line for me. And I will never use an argument that I know to be ropey, that I know not to be a good argument, just to try and win over the audience, for example. Whereas I suspect that Bill has done that on occasion. That makes me a little bit uncomfortable. But I can kind of see that he's got an excuse. You know, it's a debate. You know, it's not a, this isn't, This is an academic exercise. It's about winning by one way or another.
It used to be about academic exercise. As far like when you look at the older debates, it was far more about a sort of, it was more of a cohesion. It was more of a helping each other come to understand different perspectives and all that. You go back a few decades and debates are so much more about helping each other rather than clashing against each other. And I just wish debates would go back to that sort of format. We have a caller, Sir Strife of the Blind Ghost Show. Do you have any questions for our guests?
Hi, I'm Stephen. I've actually spoken to a presuppositional not long ago, and he brought up this argument, which I found absurd in a sense, but I think you maybe heard of it, called like pretty much saying, is it absolutely wrong to raise a baby for fun? That's what pretty much the whole thing was. And I was like, well, if there was one guy and there was the baby, the only two people left in the world, the only person who would have morality would be the guy. But whatever the guy does, the baby doesn't help it, right? But, you know, anything. So could that be a wrong state? Could that be wrong?
Right, so, sorry, I missed your name. Was it Speed? Did you say your name was?
No. I mean, that's, I just said your name.
Oh, okay, all right. Yeah, it's, I guess what, the word absolutely gets used in two ways, which can be a bit confusing. When people talk about absolute morality, sometimes they mean, well, look, it's just a kind of objective fact that killing is wrong. It's not just a matter of subjective opinion of personal taste or preference. So that's one way the word gets used. I think that's usually what's meant by the word absolute when Christians, for example, talk about, you know, morality being absolute, relative. But then there's this other way of using the expressions, which is that, well, what's right or morally acceptable in one context may be morally unacceptable in another context. It's all very situation dependent, isn't it, morality? And you can't just have a rule, a set of, you know, a list of do's and don'ts, which we then have to stick to, irrespective of what the particular context might happen to be. So, you know, you have to relativize to the context. And now those are two quite different ways of using the word absolute. And I'm wondering which of those you have in mind when you make them.
Well, I think I can probably help out. This has a lot to do with this is something that's been coming up a lot lately. It's the avenue of presuppositional apologetics. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure how familiar you are with it, but.
Yes.
Yeah, this particular avenue has been popularized by an apologist named Sajid Rugenkett. The conversation goes, is it impossible for a god to exist? And generally people say, well, no, it's not impossible, though there's a lot of questions that arise from just that question alone. Just, well, what do you mean by God? I know you mean the Christian God, but what do you define as the Christian God? I don't know whether or not it is possible because I don't quite understand the concept. but the concession is usually made, no, I guess it's not impossible for a God to exist. And then he'll go on and ask other things. Is it impossible for this to exist, for this to exist? Do absolutes exist? Generally, people are a little, they have a bit of a stigma towards the word absolute in the way in which he's defining it, because I think he's generally using the word as, this is absolute in the sense that it cannot ever be wrong, no possibility of it being wrong. And so he'll say, is there an absolute moral law? And if you say no, then he'll say, okay, well, is it absolutely wrong to rape babies? And at that point, it's a bit of a rhetorical trick, because no matter what you say there, you're kind of lost, because if you already said there's no absolutes and you say, well, yes, then you've admitted there's an absolute. If you say no, then you just conceded, well, it's okay to rape babies in certain contexts, without really getting any sort of context as to what exactly is meant by absolute moral. It's really very confusing.
Yes. Okay, so I think, no, I'm a little bit familiar with Sai, because I had a long exchange with him on my blog. I got a blog you should check it out. It's www.stephenlaw.org, Stephen with a PH. If you look in the sidebar, I think Sire is in there somewhere, or presuppositionalism is. And we had this very, very long exchange going back over hundreds, I think, of back and forths, my excuse for engaging with Sire was that I was in Spain at the time, and I'd been mountain biking, and I fell off my mountain bike and broke both collarbones. So I was kind of immobile and in great pain. His comments were coming into my blog, and I spent a lot of time kind of engaging in a conversation with him about presuppositionalism. And he has this amazingly convoluted and elaborate argument. It's a bit like talking to someone that's rung you up to try and sell you double glazing down the phone. They've got a script in front of them, and they ask you a question, and you give your response, and then your response elicits another question from their script, and so on. And you know that there's no way out of that conversation other than putting the phone down. The only way you're going to get out of it is to just hang up, because whatever you say, there's a scripted response, and it will take you round and round. Round and round in circles. Of course, there is one other way out, and that's just to agree with Sire that Sire's correct. So I indulged Sire, and I got involved in his scripted responses, and we went round and round and round and round the houses many times, and I kept trying to point out that he was engaging in bad arguments, and that there were logical problems with what he was saying. And if anyone's interested, you can, by all means, go and have a look at. That is my smoke alarm going off, by the way.
Nice. It stopped. Wow.
Yeah. That's my wife doing some cooking.
That startled the hell out of me.
Yeah. No, that was toast or something. I'm pretty sure the building's not on fire. I think we're okay.
All right.
So if you're interested in what I had to say with about Sire and presuppositionalism, by all means, go and check that out. I think you're right. Yes. Yeah, so Sire and presuppositionalists will tend to say things like, do you believe that something is absolutely wrong? And you'll say yes. And then they'll say, but the only way it can be absolutely wrong is if God exists. So God exists. You're presupposing that God exists by making that particular judgment. And they'll do that with moral value, for example. But they'll also do it with, for example, the use of logic itself. In fact, that's really Sire's favorite version of the argument. If you try and argue against Sire, he will say, aha, I've got you now, because you're using logic, right? And in fact, you can only use logic, you can only be entitled to use logic if you've already established that God exists. So you have to presuppose that God exists in order for you to be able to place your trust in logic. So your argument against me is self-defeating. You see, you presuppose my God, you should agree with me. He runs that kind of argument. Very, very irritating, obviously.
And,
wait, Stephen, would you agree mm-hmm. logic presupposes the self, in a sense? That you need the self to, in order for logic to work?
No, I don't think I would agree.
Yeah. It depends on what you mean by logic. I mean, if you're talking about language, if you're talking about the language of logic, the way in which logic is used, I would say that requires minds. That requires a thing to actually be employing logic. But if you're talking about what logic refers to, then
yeah, the description.
Yeah. If you mean what logic refers to, i.e., what perhaps the logical laws refer to, then no, those things do not require a mind in order to exist in some sort of way. If you want to employ logic, that would require a mind, I would say, and that would require a self, but it doesn't require an absolute mind. That's for damn sure.
I mean, so pretty much to that argument that guy gave on me, Stephen,
mm-hmm.
what would you say to reply to that with saying, is because, pretty much saying, well, that God exists because it's absolutely wrong raping babies for fun. Pretty much that's what the guy said.
Yeah, well, he's going to have to, presumably, he's got a little argument that goes something along the lines of, if you believe in objective morality, then you know you have to believe in God. There can only be objective moral facts if my God exists. And well, you know, good luck with that then, trying to establish that that is true. he's under an obligation to provide you with some supporting argument at that point. Typically, I think, what usually happens though is that when you challenge him to provide the argument, he turns the tables on you and says, oh yeah, but look, you're here are you using reason and argument and challenging me, but my challenge to you is to explain what, you know, explain your entitlement to use logic against me. And he keeps bringing it back to that again and again and again and again. And then he claims that he's won if you fail to provide an adequate justification. He says, well, then I've established that my God exists because you failed to justify logic in any other way other than the way that I do.
I agree. I tried giving an example where, in a sense, you can't define that it's wrong to rape a baby because if you're the only person, you know, who knows morality, person, and the baby's the only other person left, you know, like, everyone else is gone, how could you have, you know, make sense of that, right?
Well, they're a good question. It's a really good, you know, I'm not even a moral philosopher, so I don't have any great expertise in this area, I have to admit. But I am just confused, to be perfectly honest, about the nature of moral judgment and exactly what's going on there. Like most people, my intuition is that there are objective moral facts and that certain things are wrong and would still be wrong even if there was no one around to think that they were wrong, or even if people, as a matter of fact, didn't think that they were wrong. They're just wrong, period. It's not just a matter of subjective taste or preference or personal opinion. Most people have that intuition to begin with. And then, typically, religious people will try and exploit that and say, well, you can only really have that kind of objectivity if my particular deity exists to underpin it. I'm not sure that there's any good argument for that conclusion. The onus is very much on your opponent, really, at that point, to supply the argument. It's not you need to know what argument they're going to run before you can refute it. You can say, well, look, yeah, I'll leave it
up.
I'll leave it.
Okay, sir.
I will say, Sir Strive, if you're interested, there is a very long series on YouTube by a user named Known No More.
I just watched that series, actually.
You watched the entire series?
Yeah, I just watched it.
It's a pretty difficult series. Like, he gives a very, very long script to counter Psy's script, and that's kind of one of the issues that I have with not only presuppositionalism, but, you know, all the arguments that tend to come with it, like tag, the moral argument with God and all that kind of stuff. It's one of the issues I have that these arguments, from my perspective, are not meant to convince people of the truth, because most people, when they hear them, sounds like rhetorical or semantic tricks. It doesn't actually sound like an actual argument. So, and the problem with them being, they're very hard to take apart in a short amount of time. They take a decent amount of explaining of what terms mean, of what you mean by your answers. And generally that's not given to you when you're arguing with somebody who uses tag or presuppositionalism. Because they want like a yes or no answer, and once you get that answer, they're going to move on to the next question, because it's a part of a script that they're trying to play on you, and if you don't follow the script, they'll put you back on script, and they don't really care what your answer is. And that's kind of one of the big issues I have, is that it's not meant to convince anybody. It's a very dishonest, as far as I'm concerned, or at least disingenuous form of arguing.
Well, I would agree, because like I've noticed that the whole argument itself pretty much works by the yes or no scenario. You can never say like, well, couldn't you just say maybe, or couldn't you say neither? It's neither yes or no. Some of the questions of them, like, is it absolutely wrong? You know, like that thing. Like, I actually said it's neither to the guy.
I think that what's being exploited is I think it's worth being honest, actually, when people ask you questions about, you know, what is the foundation of morality, what is the basis of logic, and so on, I think it's perfectly okay to say, you know what, I'm not sure I know the answer to that question. I mean, these are questions that people have been grappling with for thousands of years. And the fact is, there is no real consensus about what the right answer is. And, you know, it's perfectly okay to say, you know, I don't know. It doesn't follow from that that their particular answer is correct, or that they have shown that their particular answer is correct. You know, if you ask, if a Christian asks you why are things right or wrong, and you say, I'm not sure about that, they'll say, I know, it's because God says so. And if they ask you, do you know where the universe came from? And you say, I'm not sure. They'll say, I know, God made it, and so on. And so the conversation continues in that way. They're certain, they have the answers, and your inability to provide answers certainly with that level of certainty is taken to show that somehow you are forced to concede that their answer is the correct one. But of course that doesn't follow at all. This is all an elaborate ruse, a sleight of hand that's going on here. On this particular question, moral value and its objectivity, most people have an intuition that morality is objective, that it is not just a matter of personal taste or preference. It may be that at the end of the day, however, that you can't have objective morality if there is no God. I don't believe that, but let's suppose that a theist could actually show that that is true. Okay? Does that prove that God exists? No, it does not. Because it might be that although it's true that you can only have objective moral facts if there is a God, it may be that there is no God, in which case we don't have objective moral facts. And that is the conclusion that I would accept if I can show that there is no God, which I can, because I can run the evidential problem of evil and show, beyond any reasonable doubt, that, you know, size God, that particular God, does not exist. We can establish that beyond reasonable doubt. So even if he can get me to concede that, oh yes, it's true that, you know, that there can only be objective moral facts, which I intuitively, you know, find that thought appealing. Even if that could be shown to me, demonstrated to me, that yes, there could only be objective moral facts if there is a God, well, the rational thing for me to do at that point is just to give up on objective moral facts, and maybe that is the right position to hold. The one thing that he hasn't done there is establish that his God exists. So that's how I see the moral argument. It is a remarkably feeble argument to put up against the evidential problem of evil. The right conclusion to draw when someone runs that argument is, first of all, to point out that the onus is on them to show that there can be objective moral facts only if there's a God. And then, even if they can do that, which they probably can't, the fact is that if I can then show that their God does not exist, then the rational, which I can, I believe, then the rational thing for me to do is just to give up on objective moral facts. And actually lots of atheists do that in any case. That would be the rational conclusion for me to draw. The moral argument is a pretty weak argument. It's logically full of holes, usually, as it's presented. And in any case, when you put it up against something like the evidential problem of evil, the evidential problem of evil just steamrolls over it.
Okay, Sir Strife, is that everything?
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you very much for the call.
We have quite a few chat room questions and comments to go over here for a moment. The first question is from the Atheist Jehovah, a very fun name there. He wants us to ask whether or not you think reason, the tool I believe that we use, is linear or circular in the sense, do we presuppose reason or do we reason with reason?
Yes. Yeah. Well, I think what's going on here is that I'm being asked to explain, justify reason, and it is a very thorny, tricky question, isn't it? How do you justify reason? Because presumably you would have to give some sort of argument, supposing that reason was a reliable tool when it comes to finding out what's true. But if you give an argument, well, you'll be using reason. Okay? And if you use reason to justify your use of reason, then that is a circular justification. And a circular justification is no justification at all, is it? I mean, it's a bit like trusting a second-hand car salesman because he himself says he's trustworthy. That's no justification whatsoever. So using reason to justify reason would itself be no justification at all. But how else can you justify reason other than by using reason? If the answer is, well, you can't, then it seems that we're plunged into this horrible skeptical doubt about reason. It seems that we can't justify our use of it, that we can make no case for saying that it's a reliable tool when it comes to establishing what's true. And that is then immediately exploited by anyone who whose belief system has been on the receiving end of a rational battery, because they'll play that card at that point. And they see the tide of rationality is very much against them, that they're on the losing side so far as the argument is concerned. It's very tempting to get sceptical about reason and seem to insist that reason is just another faith position after all. That's one of the strategies that's covered in my book, Believing Bullshit. I'm not sure if the questioner is getting at that point, but it sounded to me as if that's the concern they're raising. That how do we avoid being skeptics about reason? Is that right?
Well, he's clarified here. He says, I think the issue is stating reason is reasonable, is that a tautology? And if that's the case, then can it not be said that that's not circular in the fallacious sense?
Reason. Well, there have been attempts to get out of this problem by defining it away. So you might say, well, thinking in this kind of way is just what we call reasonable. So it is reasonable by definition. It's a bit like calling the unmarried males bachelors. I mean, I don't have to justify my calling them that. That's just what it means, right? And so if you say reasoning in thinking in this kind of way, that's just what we mean by being reasonable, well, then no justification for calling that way of thinking reasonable is even required. It's just true by definition. So you could try that. But that doesn't really, to be honest, deal with the problem, because what we're really interested in is why should we think that these particular ways of thinking and arriving at beliefs is reliable when it comes to revealing the truth? Why think that these are truth-conducive ways of thinking as opposed to flipping a coin or asking the psychic or some other method? What reason do we have for thinking that reason is a reliable method of arriving at true belief? And saying, oh, but this is just what we call reasonable, provides no satisfactory answer to that question. So that would just be a bit of sleight of hand with words.
When I get the question, well, personally, when I get the question as to, like, how do we know that reasoning is valid in some way, I always remember a story that I remember reading. I can't remember from book, but it was one of Plato's books, from Socrates. And the question was asked of Socrates, how do you know that reasoning is valid, essentially? And he said to even ask the question is to presuppose reason. So doubting reason in that sense necessarily defeats itself, because you're using reason to find reason.
That's a good point. In attempting to argue that reason is unreliable and not to be trusted, you would be using reason, presumably, to do that. And so your argument against using reason would be self-defeating. So you can at least point that out. You can at least point out that your opponent, if he's using some kind of argument in order to construct this kind of skeptical position about reason, would be constructing an argument that was self-defeating. But that's not to get you out of trouble yet, because you still have to justify your use of reason to explain why you think it's a reliable method when it comes to arriving at true belief, and that you still haven't done, even if you can point out that his argument is going to be against reason is self-defeating. Well, maybe the most obvious thing you could do, this may or may not work, but one thing you could do is you could say, sometimes you can just see that the most basic of logical inferences are valid, are truth preserving. You know, you don't have to apply reason to see that this follows from that when you're looking at a very, very simple, straightforward inference. You can just see that if that's true, then that must be true. It's a matter of perception rather than applying your some kind of inference at that point. if you always have to appeal to an inference to justify any inference, well, then the inference you appeal to, in order to justify the first inference, would itself need an inference to justify it, and so on, and you produce an infinite regress. The only way out of that, presumably, is to say that at some point there's a way of acknowledging the reasonableness of the inference that doesn't involve introducing yet another inference. And the most obvious thing to say is you can just see it. That's where you hit bedrock.
The way I predict, this is just my prediction as to how someone who might be trying to fight against your usage of reason might do, if you lodge that at them, they would probably define reason in a way as just being able to see it is utilizing reason in itself. So it's just an inescapable thing that you're using reason, regardless of whether or not you say, well, you can just see it. Well, that's using reason. That's kind of how I predict they would say.
Well, they could say that, but it's really not if it's non-inferential, if it's just a straightforward, you can just see it, and you're not engaging any kind of inference, then you no longer have to justify inferential reason. Because the most basic steps can be non-inferentially accepted now on the basis of you can just see that they are going to be true observing. But look, there is this famous puzzle, right, about how you justify reason. I know we could argue this, we could sit here and talk about it all day. It's a very interesting puzzle. But why does it come up in conversations about gods or fairies or the paranormal, or why does this suddenly rear its head, this skeptical question? And the answer is that it provides those whose beliefs have been rationally challenged with a kind of escape hatch. It allows them to say something like this: well, you know, you've given an argument against what I believe. You've used rationality against me, but can you even justify your use of rationality? No, you can't, can you? And at this point, if you can't justify reason, then all of our beliefs, mine and yours, turn out ultimately to rest on nothing but faith. It's faith positions all round, okay? So you can bring every belief down to the same level of reasonableness. I call this strategy going nuclear, because it's like the kind of mutually assured destruction that you used to get during the Cold War, where, you know, you explode the nuclear device and everything is brought down to the same level. Well, if you explode this particular skeptical bomb, you're skeptical about reason, all beliefs have become equally reasonable. And so the person whose beliefs you've been challenging with reason can get out the door quick with their head held high, claiming that your position is no less a faith position than theirs. And that's the strategy that, frankly, really pisses me off. It's not that there isn't an interesting question about how you justify reason, but the truth is that they're not really interested in that question. They're just using it as a smokescreen, as a rhetorical device. The truth is that they were more than happy to use reason whilst they thought that the argument was going their way. They only get skeptical once they realize that the tide of rationality is going against them. You can also be sure that the minute that you've left the room, if the topic is belief in fairies or gods or whatever, that they will start using reason again the minute that you as the challenger have left. They're more than happy to rely on reason at that point to reintroduce it back into the debate. And the fact is that they trust reason every day. They trust their lives to it. Whenever they press the brakes on their car and suppose their car is going to stop, they're trusting reason. They're making an inference. They trust their lives to reason. They rely on it. The only reason they get skeptical at this point about this particular topic is because they realize they're in trouble. And so they selectively adopt a skeptical position that they do not even believe themselves in order to try and make quick their escape, create enough philosophical confusion, raise enough philosophical dust to be able to get out the door quick and with their head held high. And that's just intellectually dishonest. And that's what really bothers me about the people that play the, oh, it's just another faith position card in these kind of debates. It's just intellectually dishonest. And it happens so often that that I introduced this term, going nuclear, to cover it, and stuck it in the Believing Bullshit book. So next time you see someone do it, just say, you're going nuclear, and refer them to...
That sounds like a lot of fun to actually do. You are going to this fine book right here.
Yeah. There's another way of going nuclear, which is to kind of play a relativist card. But that's another story. Has the same effect.
There's kind of two points I want to raise about that, and then we'll go on to the call that we just got.
Okay.
The first point, the whole idea that everything rests on faith. That point, I'm willing to concede that point, if only because I can demonstrate something that's a little more frightful about the epistemology of people who already accept that they believe certain things on faith. Like, if you want to go back and say that presupposing any sort of avenue of knowing anything is based ultimately on faith because reasoning is circular and blah, 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 then sure, I have faith and you have faith. But I have faith in much less stuff than you do. I have faith that evidence will bring me to a most probable conclusion. I have faith that reason will allow me to be able to conclude that which is most probably true. I have faith in these things. Meanwhile, the interlocutor, the theist or the supernaturalist or anything like that, has faith in way more things. Say you're a Christian. You not only have faith in evidence and reason, but you also have faith in something that cannot be come to by an avenue of evidence, i.e. something that is outside of empirical research that would be a timeless, spaceless, whatever God. Mm-hmm. You have faith in perhaps the virgin birth. If you're a Christian, you have faith in that Muhammad talked to ghosts. If you're a Muslim, you have faith in so many more things than I do. So, sure, yeah. If you want to see that we both have faith, fine. You have a lot more of it than I do.
Well, you might be right, but there's something they might say at this point. They may say, well, hang on a minute, because here's the bottom line faith thing for me, that God exists. That a God exists who is a God of love and compassion who made us in his image, and he is a knower. So he would have made us knowers in his image. I don't mean knower like Noah's Ark. I mean, you know, beings that can know. So he will have given us reliable cognitive faculties, senses, five senses, window onto the world, an ability to think things through reliably, faculty of reason, memory, and so on. So once I take that one faith step, I am then in a position reasonably to place to place trust in all of my other cognitive faculties. I just have to make the one faith move. You, on the other hand, have to have faith in your memory, have to have faith in your ability to draw reliable inferences, have to have faith in all of your five senses, and so on. So actually, it's you that's having to make many more appeals to faith. All I have to do is place my faith in one thing, and suddenly I get reliability so far as all of these other things are concerned. So isn't my position rather more economical than yours in terms of faith? What if they say that?
I would say that they're sort of relying on a level of consistency. And consistency isn't necessarily a good thing. You can make any sort of level of belief consistent, no matter what it is. Like, take the presuppositionalists, for example. When they presuppose that a God exists, they say, well, yes, we're both being circular, but I'm consistent with mine because my God can account for this. Well, no, you can't. Your consistency relies on a presupposition that you yourself cannot justify in any way. And not only can't you justify the presupposition, you can't answer any question about your presupposition. For instance, when you ask them, where does God come from, for instance, they'll say, well, God is timeless. God always was. Great, so nothing preceded God. So God doesn't really exist for any particular reason. Nothing caused him to exist. God is kind of random as far as his existence goes. Why is his will effective rather than ineffective? And they'll say, well, he's God. He's just defined as having an effective will. Well, that's also something you can't account for, because that's the equivalent of me saying that the universe just is the way it is. So if it's not acceptable for me to do that with my epistemology, then it's equally unacceptable for you to do the same with yours. And you're using something that you equally cannot account for to try and account for these other things that you say I can't account for. So yours isn't exactly all that economically sound. It's not very parsimonious, I could say, in that sense.
Yeah. I mean, I think you're on I think you're on, yeah, I think you're on the right track. I'm not sure if it's, I'm not sure if the issue is parsimony so much as, I mean, the particular problems that you raised there, they had got answers, you know, worked out, pretty sophisticated ones. But I mean, maybe what, I think this is what I would say to someone who says you're trusting your senses. That's just a faith position. For all you know, you could be living in the Matrix. How do you know that you're not? You have to place your faith in your senses, whereas I don't, because I have faith in God. And once I know that God exists, then I know that given that God like that exists, he's going to give me reliable senses. So it's not a faith issue for me, having reliable senses. So we're on par in terms of, you know, having to appeal to faith. But I think that you could, what you can then say, and I think I'm really probably just repeating what you just said, but see what you think. What you can then say is that, well, okay then, so let's suppose that we've got reliable senses. We're both taking that as read. Now let's use our senses, look at the world around us, and what do we find? We find unbelievable amounts of suffering over hundreds of millions of years that constitutes fantastically good evidence against the existence of your particular God. So here's the asymmetry between our positions. You start off with God, from which you derive your, you know, the thought that you have reliable senses. When you apply those senses, they then reveal excellent evidence that your God does not exist. So your, ultimately, your faith position turns out to be self-defeating or self-undermining. Mine does not. My senses do not provide me with good evidence that my senses are not reliable. So there's a kind of consistency to my position as an atheist that is lacking in the position of the theist, it seems to me. Now, some theists have attempted to redress the balance here. So Alvin Plantinga, for example, by suggesting that actually our use of our senses reveals facts about our evolutionary history that should lead us not to trust our senses. So even the atheist ends up back in the skeptical soup. I don't find that particular argument persuasive. But the point is that actually there is this, I think, far more serious problem for the theist who believes in God, places his faith in God, that leads him to trust his senses, he applies his senses, and his senses reveal that there ain't no God. That's a self-undermining position, so far as faith is concerned. I do not believe that atheism suffers from the same kind of deficit.
I do want to get into planning as a naturalist here, as we have been putting our caller on hold.
Okay.
So I'm going to go ahead and ask our caller, James, do you have any questions for our guest?
Yes, good afternoon. Also, also an Englishman, and I loved the book, The War for for Children's Minds. We did it last month at my university.
Which university was that?
At the University of Hull Scarborough campus, we were doing a little. It came up during a particular discussion in English literature. I kind of going off topic a little bit, but I've always wondered what with kind of the theorizing of Alain de Botton and people suggesting education and universities were the replacement for the instilling of morality, if you like, because church numbers were declining. With regards to kind of critical thinking and reasoning, as you've been speaking about, when exactly do you think it important or necessary to start instilling children with the ability of debate and critical thinking? And do you think they're capable of it at an earlier age than they're currently being taught?
Right, well, these are empirical questions, really, aren't they? And I'm a philosopher, I'm not any kind of empirical scientist. I haven't spent a lot of time investigating just at what stage of their development children are capable of engaging in a certain kind of intellectual activity. You need to ask a psychologist. However, there has been research done into the use of what's sometimes called P4C, philosophy for children, which is a particular kind of way of getting them to think about issues and talk collectively about issues that has a kind of philosophical character to it. And that particular approach has been tried in classrooms, piloted in classrooms in Australia, in Scotland. There was a big trial in Clackmannanshire, for example, run by somebody from the University of Dundee, and increasing numbers of schools. And the evidence is, on the face of it, that these programs are very good at producing not only measurably more intelligent children. So, for example, the Clackmannanshire study, they measured the IQ of kids 2 years after the program was completed. They were only ever getting an hour or two a week of this kind of activity. And there was a control group of schools where they didn't have this kind of activity. And they found that 2 years later, the kids that had the exposure to philosophy 2 years earlier, just a little bit, their IQ was 6 points higher than those from the control group. So there's evidence to suggest that exposure to philosophy at a fairly young age is good for kids intellectually and academically, but there's also evidence to suggest that exposure to this kind of philosophical activity is good for them in terms of their moral and cultural development. Schools seem to have a better ethos when they run these kinds of programs. There tends to be less bullying, for example. The kids have more respect for each other, and so on. So I think that it'd be a very good idea to get more of this kind of stuff going on in schools. And I think even Ofsted inspectors, Ofsted being the
yes.
organisation that looks at schools and examines them in this country, even they are now reporting very favourably on these kind of programmes and suggesting that they have a very good effect on kids. As to what age you can do it at, I've talked to teachers who've done it with kids as young as five. I mean, clearly you have to tailor it. So, you know, the kind of activity that you're engaging in to the level that the kids are at. You can certainly do it at a pretty young age. And certainly my own kids, I think, you know, they were really pretty naturally pretty philosophical from a fairly young age. I don't know whether it's in our genes, in our family or what, but they would just spontaneously ask the big questions. And want to talk about them. And I think that for many parents, that's kind of uncomfortable. They don't want to get sucked into a debate about the morality of eating meat as they're sat at the dinner table, say, or get sucked into a question about life after death. It could be very awkward or difficult, or questions about God and so on. So we tend naturally very often to shut these kind of conversations down, or perhaps even feel rather embarrassed about having them with our children. But I think the evidence is building now that actually it's a really good idea to have those kind of philosophical conversations with your kids and to encourage them to think and question. One of the things that, if you're familiar with my book, The War for Children's Minds, one of the things that I did look at was the backgrounds of those who saved Jews during the Holocaust. There's some research has been done. There was a book published by a couple called Pearl and Samuel Oliner. The book was called The Altruistic Personality. Now, you often hear it said that it was religion that motivated the rescuers, that was what really marked them out as rescuers and gave them that impetus to perhaps risk their own lives to save others. But actually, that's not what the research revealed, not the research that was done by the Oliners. They found that there was some positive effect from religion, but it was fairly negligible compared to what really marked out the rescuers was the fact that they'd been raised in what they called a non-authoritarian way, that they'd been raised to think and question, that they had been raised not to feel mere pawns or passive receptors of dogma, but they had really been encouraged to think and question and engage in conversations and see issues from other points of view other than their own. That was what really marked out the rescuers. So it seems to me that if we want to raise citizens that will not be sucked into these kind of moral catastrophes that marred the 20th century, what we need to do is appeal not to more religion, but to have more of that kind of free thought going on. That's the kind of thing that we need to be encouraging, particularly in schools. And unfortunately, schools have, in recent years, become more and more little factories of indoctrination in one way or another. I don't necessarily mean religious indoctrination, but yeah, here are the facts, learn the facts, memorize them, regurgitate them, you've passed, move on to the next level. There's very little emphasis on critical thinking.
I suppose that's the struggle of philosophy, in a way, to beat that rote system, because it is such a questionable field, as with literature and science in some respects, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, I think people often look at philosophy and think, well, that's a head-in-the-cloud discipline. What's the point of that? That's not going to get you a job. Why would you bother? But actually, if you look at... I don't think people should particularly do philosophy because it's a good career choice. But as a matter of fact, it's not a bad career choice, it turns out. If you look at the GRE scores, the graduate record examination scores, so that's an exam which you sit in your third or your final year as an undergraduate in the United States, whatever degree you're doing, you do a GRE exam. And I think it has three components which are roughly mathematical, analytical, and linguistic or verbal. And so the three components together add up to a kind of a general test of intelligence and aptitude. Somebody took the time to look at the GRE scores for all of the different 50 degree programs for which they had the data. And these included science degrees and humanities degrees and things like business administration and so on. And what they found was that out of 50 degree programs, on the analytic measure, philosophy came first. And you might think, well, that's not surprising because philosophers are very analytical and so on. On the linguistic component, they also came top out of 50 degree programs. I mean, they were outperforming people doing English as a degree subject, for example.
Yes.
And they also outperformed all humanities degrees on the mathematical measure. They came first out of all humanities degrees, and in fact, it was ninth ranking. The top eight positions were all taken by very maths-heavy science subjects. So philosophy, it turns out, is one of the very best programs to do if you want to turn out as someone with good all-round skills, intellectual skills of the sort that employers presumably, particularly when it comes to the more rewarding professions, the kind of skills that employers value. I'm taking a little bit of a liberty there because I'm assuming that there's some kind of causal connection, aren't I, between doing philosophy and those particular outcomes. And maybe that is a little bit of a leap, but it's not that much of a leap. I think that philosophy is very, very good at producing smart, well-rounded people with a wide range of abilities who employers surely should be valuing. When you look at something like business administration, on the other hand, that did terribly on the GRE scores. And accountancy was diabolically bad. And yet these are the kind of programs that people are increasingly turning to now in this age of austerity. People think, oh, I really should do something useful like business administration. The people that do business administration look at their GRE scores and then compare it to those scores to those who do philosophy. Also, just look at the people that do the law entrance exam in the United States, the LSAT. I think out of 50 degree programs, philosophy comes first. So philosophers, good, employable, well-rounded, well-educated individuals. It has a reputation for being a head in the clouds discipline, but the fact is that philosophers have skills that are very valuable across a wide range of professions. That was my advert for philosophy.
Very good. Thank you very much. That was great.
Yeah, thank you very much, James.
Thank you.
We always need more adverts for philosophy. As the general public feeling, as far as philosophy goes, tends to be, oh, those guys in their ivory tower with their heads in the clouds, they're not really doing anything substantial. Yeah. Let's just go to the scientists. It's always... That's something that seems to be a little... It's a growing predominant force as far as that's concerned, and it's very disheartening for me. Before I continue on with things that I want to talk about, I have been bogarting the entirety of the show's time, and I'd like to open it up to my co-hosts here to ask their questions.
All right, Kitch, you've been sitting on a question.
Sure. Sorry I haven't been speaking up. It's a little late here, and my mind is just... not in tune. But when I was living in Canada, I had a philosopher as a roommate, and he argued that philosophy is very important to science as math is. And I just wanted your opinion on that stance. Is that overstating the case or understating it?
Well, once you start pushing the envelope a bit when it comes to science, you can quickly start coming up against philosophical questions. And those philosophical questions can be, you know, can be very fruitful to think about them for science. And I think it wasn't it Einstein who said that he owed quite a debt to David Hume, reading David Hume, so far as the development of his scientific theories was concerned. So I could point to that. The question about the relationship between philosophy and science, I mean, that's a tricky one. And if you ask different philosophers, you're going to get different answers. But my own view about philosophy is, I mean, I have a fairly modest view, I suppose, about philosophy and what philosophers can do. I think that what we're doing when we do philosophy is we're engaging in kind of conceptual engineering, to borrow an expression that was coined by philosopher Simon Blackburn, I think, very well-known British philosopher. They are conceptual questions, and they have a peculiar conceptual character, and those are the questions that philosophers specialize in, and they are questions that typically just aren't amenable to a scientific approach. They're just not that kind of question. They work in a different dimension, if you like. So now, scientists hate it when you say that very often. I mean, not all of them. Plenty of them will acknowledge that, no, that there are questions that science can't answer, and they are some of the most important questions. But a lot of them tend to be very dismissive of philosophy. And I had a long conversation with Richard Dawkins a month or two ago in Oxford, and we spent some time talking about philosophy and science. And I really wanted to kind of find out what he thought about philosophy a little bit more, because my impression had always been that he was really rather dismissive about philosophers and perhaps lumped us in with theologians. And he really doesn't have any time at all for the theologians. So, you know, not much more time for the philosophers. But actually, after we talked about philosophy and science for a bit, I think I was kind of surprised. I mean, he did appear to think that what I was doing, when I described what it was that I was doing, was a worthwhile activity. It's just that he ended up saying, but I would just call that science. It turns out that any kind of rational activity, even if it's not empirically based, even if it's just done in your armchair with your eyes shut, having a good old think, as long as it's reasoning that you're engaged in, well, that's science. And I don't care what you call it much. As long as Richard Dawkins thinks that what I do is okay and has some time for it, I'm happy. If he wants to call it science, that's fine by me. I think I'll continue to call it philosophy. Because it's non-empirical. It is an armchair discipline. Well, I haven't really done, have I suppose, is here's an illustration of that I like very much from the history of science, which illustrates how armchair methods can be very valuable. Okay, so by armchair methods I mean, you know, you can figure out something just by sitting in your armchair and having a good old think about it with your eyes shut and your fingers in your ears. You're not doing any observing of the world around you. You're not applying the scientific method at all. But you can still establish something very, very significant. So this is what Galileo did. Galileo thought about Aristotle's theory that, which had the consequence that if you had two steel balls, one with much greater mass than the other, and if you were to release them simultaneously from a tall tower, say, that the more massive ball would fall more quickly than the less massive ball. And Galileo, legend has it, went to the top of the Tower of Pisa and threw the balls off to see which landed first, and found that they both landed at the same time, thus refuting the Aristotelian theory. But actually, he probably didn't do that, and in fact Galileo makes it clear himself that he didn't need to do it. Why not? Because you can do a thought experiment, an armchair experiment, that will establish that Aristotle's theory cannot be true. So the thought experiment is this. Imagine that you take your two steel balls, the big one and the small one, and you chain them together. You have now combined their mass, so they're even more massive than they were before. So Aristotle's theory should entail that they will travel even more, they will fall even more quickly than the single ball. However, the small ball, being chained to the larger ball, will now function as a brake on the larger ball. And so Aristotle's theory has the consequence that the two balls combined with the chain should now fall more slowly than did the individual balls. So in other words, Aristotle's theory generates a logical contradiction. The two balls combined with the chain will fall faster than they did individually, but also more slowly than they did individually. And if you can show that a theory generates a logical contradiction, you've established that it's not true. So, and that's what Galileo did. It's a very famous thought experiment from the history of science. Galileo showed that Aristotle's theory is false, and he did it from the comfort of his armchair with his eyes shut. Now that actually is philosophy. That's what philosophers do. It's an example that gets subsumed under science, because it's obviously Galileo, and it was a theory about empirical reality, designed to predict what would happen. That's what he was refuting there. It was a scientific theory that he was refuting. But he did it through philosophical reflection, just conceptual work, you know, just having a good old think. You can establish things of great significance in that way, and that's just one example. So I think that's a very nice illustration of how, other than by applying the scientific method, you can establish things from the comfort of your armchair, things which are really very important. And of course, there are lots of other things you can think about too. Moral questions, notoriously difficult for science to answer, questions about right and wrong, because science, you know, to frame it in a Humean way, science deals with the is facts, the facts about what is the case, whereas morality is about what one ought or ought not to do. And it's very difficult to see how you can ultimately justify moral claims then by appeal to is facts. There's a kind of a logical lacuna there. And then questions about why the universe has the most fundamental physical features that it does. I mean, science explains things by reference to those features. It's hard to see how science could actually account for those features, or indeed for the existence of anything at all. Why is there anything at all? Why is there something other than nothing? Not on the face of it, a question that science can answer. Now, many scientists, like Richard Dawkins, will say, oh, well, these are questions that, oh, yes, science can't answer, but that's because no one can. It's not that the theologians are going to be able to answer these questions, or anyone else. I mean, moral questions just don't have answers, I think is Dawkins' position. So the reason I like the Galileo example is that there is an answer, and you can establish it by armchair means.
Okay, Kitch, do you have a follow-up?
Trying to think. No, not at the moment. My mind just seems to be... As I said, I'm about 7 hours ahead.
Yeah, I sympathise.
All right. There's one thing I wanted to bring up. We discussed it very briefly before we went on air. And I think it's very common for a lot of lay people, what puts them off philosophy is the jargon. You know, they hear these people and very jargon heavy. Do you think philosophers should cut down on that to try and, you know, encourage people to become more involved?
Yes, I do. I'm highly distrustful of jargon. I generally will avoid it wherever I can, but sometimes, you know, it's just so much easier if you just adopt a little bit of terminology. But I'm very suspicious of jargon. It seems to me that very often it doesn't help, it hinders. And I'm certainly a big fan of explaining stuff as clearly and concisely as possible. I very much endorse that quote from the philosopher John Searle, I think it is, who once said, if you can't explain it clearly, that's probably because you don't understand it yourself. There's a lot of that may not be universally true. there's a lot of truth to that. Unfortunately, there are some philosophers, perhaps some branches of philosophy, that have more than their fair share of pseudes and intellectual posers with very little to say, but who manage to dress it up in such great clouds of hot air and verbiage that they sound far more profound than they really are. And I have no time for that sort of philosophy, and those kind of philosophers give what I do a bad name, as far as I'm concerned. And in fact, I dedicated a whole chapter of believing bullshit to exposing that kind of bullshit. I'm a big fan of Sokal and his hoax. I'm not sure if you are familiar with that, the Sokal hoax. Well, Sokal was he's still alive. He's a scientist, a physicist, he was very much bothered by the kind of postmodern articles that were being published. Yeah, the pennies dropped, right? Okay, that were just full of references to quantum mechanics and other bits of physics, and it was clearly all gibberish. They didn't really understand what they were talking about, but they made these references in order to try and give themselves some sort of academic credibility. And these papers were being published in journals, such as one journal, and I think it was called Social Text or something like that. Anyway, so what Sokal did is he constructed a paper that was complete bullshit from beginning to end, but had lots of references to quantum mechanics and science and so on, and ticked all of the boxes so far as the postmodern jargon was concerned. You know, it had all the right buzzwords in it, and he submitted it to the journal, and they published it. And that was a kind of an emperor's new clothes moment for that particular style of philosophy. Suddenly, everyone was laughing at them, and with some reason, actually. Not everyone that works in the continental tradition or the postmodern tradition is an intellectual charlatan, but unfortunately quite a few people are, and Sokal really brought that out.
There does seem to be a sort of like an intractable language barrier when it comes to more complex philosophical thought than when it comes to appealing to the public audience, though. I remember Richard Feynman said, if you cannot explain it in a way that makes sense to a high schooler, then you don't know it. I kind of agree with that. The problem is, when you put something into simple terms, it sort of opens up the doors for people to misconstrue what you mean when you use certain terms, which requires you to sort of unpack the terms that you use, which then sort of leads on to this never-ending cycle of I explained it very simply, but then these people sort of either in the more curious field or the opponent field are trying to take apart the words that I'm using, so I have to explain it a little bit more complexly to explain the words that I'm using. And then it gets more and more complex until you get to this point where almost nobody understands what you're talking about.
It can go that way, yeah. I mean, you're constantly having to be just clarify what you mean. To a very large extent, philosophy is about conceptual clarification. If you can just get clear about what the concept is, what it is that you mean, you're very often halfway there. And in fact, some philosophical puzzles can be entirely solved just by doing that kind of conceptual unpacking. In fact, I read a children's philosophy book a few years ago called The Philosophy Files, and I made a point of putting in at least one philosophical puzzle that can be clearly solved. It was the puzzle about, can you jump in the same river twice? I won't bore you with the details, but anyway, the way you solve the puzzle is you just engage in some conceptual clarification, and finally it all dissolves away. It's very satisfying thing to do, and it kind of shoots down that thought that philosophers never get anywhere and they never solve any puzzles, because like, we just solved that one, right? So yes, conceptual clarification, very, very important. You don't always have to just introduce more jargon to do that. We did see earlier on, didn't we, that when I talked about the problem of evil, well, I was using jargon, wasn't I? Because I was using that word evil in a non-standard way, in the way that the theologians tend to when they talk about that problem. And because I did that, people immediately misunderstood and thought that, well, you're talking about earthquakes causing suffering. In what sense is that evil? And that's an entirely understandable question to ask if you're familiar with the use, you know, the ordinary use of the term. It's just that I was using it in a slightly jargony way, and that caused trouble. So, in fact, it wasn't a help; it was a hindrance. My use of jargon, and I think that's really? That's very often true.
Lundy, do you have a question there?
Here we go. We've been ignoring a lot of the chat room questions and going off on our own, so I wanted to get back into that one. So one of our guests has asked, essentially, he's interested to know your position on the old argument that God can never be disproven. Is it really true that it's not disprove a negative, even when there are logical counterexamples?
Yes. You can never prove a negative gets a whole section in my book, Believing Bullshit. And if you want to see what I think about that, check out the entry, because I posted it on my blog. So you don't even have to buy the book. You can just go and find it for free. On my blog, there's an entry on you can't prove a negative. Check it out. So you jolly well can prove a negative. There are two things going on here. So there's the, you can't prove or disprove God. Well, what does the word prove mean here? This is where a little conceptual unpacking would help, wouldn't it? So because there are various things that prove means. It could mean prove beyond all possible doubt, or it could mean prove beyond reasonable doubt, like the notion of proof that's supplied in a court of law. Now, it may be true that you can't prove beyond all possible doubt that there is a God or that there isn't a God, but frankly, who cares? Because what I would aim to do is to show beyond reasonable doubt that there is no God, and it may be that I have succeeded in doing that using, say, the evidential problem of evil as an argument. It would be simply to change the subject, to say, but you can't prove that there is or isn't a God, if by that you now mean prove beyond all possible doubt, because I was never aiming to do that in the first place. I was merely aiming to establish beyond reasonable doubt there is no God, you know, which is a pretty good standard. It's the kind of standard that we require before we will send someone to prison for life, for example. So there's that kind of sleight of hand with the word proof that people engage in order to try and immunize their belief against the kind of objections that I would have to what they believe. They'll play the you can't prove it card in that kind of way. If that doesn't go down, if that doesn't succeed, they may also try the you can't prove a negative move. Well, it's just not true that you can't prove a negative. First of all, if it's true that you can't prove a negative, well, then you can't prove a negative is a negative, so you can't prove that. It's the first thing you can point out. Secondly, you certainly can prove negatives, because you can turn any positive claim into a negative claim by just negating it. So let's suppose that Descartes proved that he exists. I think, therefore I am. Well, then he proved that he doesn't not exist. That's a negative. So you can prove negatives. Now, maybe then what you can't prove a negative means is you can't prove that something doesn't exist. But is that true? I mean, I can prove that there's no unicorn in my tool shed by going down and having a good old look, and that would establish beyond reasonable doubt that there is no unicorn down there. In the same way, you could establish that there's no Loch Ness monster, by draining the lock. I mean, just take all the water out. It's going to cost a lot of money and it's going to take some time, but if you drain the lock, you can establish beyond any reasonable doubt there ain't no monster in there. You'd have proved a negative. I guess what people sometimes mean when they say you can't prove a negative is you could never establish that unicorns did not once roam the earth in its long history. Maybe eons ago, unicorns did once exist. The mere fact that we don't have any evidence of their existence is no proof of absence. Maybe they were there. Now, if that's what they mean by you can't prove a negative, well, you probably can establish beyond reasonable doubt that there have been no unicorns, because we would expect to see in the fossil record, for example, a certain kinds of evidence, and in the absence of that evidence, it's reasonable to suppose that there are no unicorns. We also know that the history of unicorns, the concept, is basically fictional. It's been made up. There's no basis in fact. So we can point to all of that stuff. If the person insists, but still, you can't prove beyond all possible doubt that the unicorns have never existed. Well, that's true of positive claims as well. I mean, you can't prove beyond all possible doubt that dinosaurs once existed. You know, you can point to the fossils, but, you know, somebody might say, yes, but then maybe those fossils were placed there by alien pranksters long ago in order to dupe us into thinking that these creatures once roamed the Earth. It's some elaborate cosmic joke on us. Is that possible? Yes. I can't prove it beyond all possible doubt that dinosaurs once roamed the Earth, but still, it's an entirely reasonable thing for me to believe. So the you can't prove a negative claim is either false or it's just irrelevant, depending on what they mean by prove. It's one of those great sleight of hand moves that people employ whenever their belief is cornered.
It sort of reminds me of what Daniel Dennett would call a statement like that, the deep. To the extent that it's true, it's trivial. To the extent that it's meaningful, it's false.
Yes, yeah, yeah. That's a nice, yeah. The deepities are in the Believing Bullshit book under the pseudo-profundity, because it's a nice way of generating pseudo-profundity. So his example is love is just a word. Love is just a word. You go, yeah, how true, how deep. And then you realise, no, but it's not, actually. First of all, if it's not just a word, it's an emotion. I mean, the one thing it clearly isn't is a word. The word love is a word, but that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about love. So it's, first of all, it's just false. If you put it in quotation marks, well, the word love is just the word, but we knew that already. That's hardly news. What happens is that there's a blurring between the two claims, and that produces the oh wow response, the kind of the sense that something profound has been said. It's a nice little recipe that you can follow. And in the Believing Bullshit book, I give various other recipes for generating that oh wow, how deep response. I've got a few recipes of my own which I've identified over the years.
If anybody wishes to use these recipes, don't use it in the sense of any sort of actual debate where you're trying to come up with much. But if you're trying to impress a girl, go for it.
Yeah, they're great for that. Or, you know, you fall on hard times, you lost your job, you want to set yourself up as a guru. It's not that difficult. You know, once you've identified the you know, there are some certain basic recipes, and once you've identified what those recipes are, all you need is, you know, a smart waistcoat and a fresh waistcoat or some other bit of clothing that sets you apart from the crowd, and a little bit of charisma, and away you go. You can be deep.
I did have another thing. We didn't really go over what I wanted to say before. We don't have a whole lot of time, but I do want to get into it a little bit. Wow, 2 hours passed by really quickly. This kind of goes back into the whole, like, when someone goes nuclear, for instance, and they're trying to say that all reason is circular and everybody takes things on faith, blah, blah, blah. I sort of look at it in the sense of it. Correct me if I'm wrong, epistemology is not something that I've looked too terribly deep into. It's, as far as I'm concerned, it always seems like a convoluted subject to me, not as a result of any sort of like sophism or anything, just it just gets into a lot of different concepts that really are hard to keep in order. But one of the things I've noticed, at the very least, is that there's a sort of intractable problem of epistemology where when you go back in anyone's epistemology, no matter which one, theistic, atheistic, whatever, there's always a certain point where there are some basic assumptions that are made in order to be able to function in a sort of reasoning world. So to then tell someone that making such an assumption is wrong to do is to necessarily defeat your own epistemology, as far as I'm concerned. Would you agree with that?
I think I would, yeah. What did you have an example in mind? What were you thinking about?
Well, generally, I kind of look at Tag, for instance, the transcendental argument for the existence of God, where they try to use logic and say, well, logical laws exist, logical laws are absolute, logic is a concept of the mind, therefore logical laws, blah, blah, are part of God's mind. Blah, blah. There's a lot of problems with that, but generally what they do is they say, if you're using logic, you have to piggyback off of my worldview, because you can't justify logic without saying that logic is just what it is, or rather the logical laws are just what they are. You can't really get reason for them being that way. We can say God did it that way. But as I mentioned before, you have the same problems. You're trying to account for something using something that you equally cannot account for. God didn't come into existence for any reason, because he always was. That's a fact that is generally agreed upon by anybody who uses Kalam, for instance. Because when you ask them, what created God? Well, God was forever. So nothing created God. God doesn't exist for a particular reason. His will is effective rather than ineffective for some reason that is indeterminable. And the fact that he does actions at all, the way in which he does them, is an unexplainable thing. So to say that this thing that you're presupposing accounts for those things, when you equally cannot account for the thing that you're presupposing in order to account for the things, is a bit of an issue for your epistemology.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think that I wouldn't be so quick to press some of those charges of kind of irrationality or then helping themselves to things that really don't make sense. I mean, well, let's not get into the nitty-gritty, but yeah, it's true that, you know, if you dig down, everyone finds that, you know, you keep digging, eventually you're going to hit bedrock. There are going to be things that you believe that you're not going to be able to ultimately justify in terms of yet another belief. If otherwise, we have sort of a regress problem, clearly. If each belief requires another belief to justify, then there'll be a belief under that one and then another belief under that one. And given that you are not entertaining incapable of entertaining an infinite number of beliefs, it's going to turn out that none of your beliefs are justified. So there are going to have to be some beliefs which function in a kind of a bedrock way, perhaps. And their justification is presumably going to have to be something other than they are arrived at or have been inferred from some yet another belief. Now, why might that be? Well, you've been talking about Psi. Psi did have one kind of interesting thought, which was intriguing, which I hadn't come across before. See if I can remember exactly how it goes. He said that when it comes to his belief that there is a God, that he knows that there's a God, that I would ask him, well, how do you know that it's true, that it's real, that this isn't some kind of illusion or deception? How do you know that it's a reliable belief, this belief that you have? And his intriguing response, I seem to remember, was something along the lines of, well, how do you know that God isn't such that he couldn't make his presence infallibly known to me? And if there is a God, presumably he would have that, potentially, that ability to make himself known to people in such a way that they simply could not be wrong about the fact that God was making himself manifest to them at that particular point. And once you've acknowledged that, oh yeah, God might be able to do that, that's a possibility, then Psi can say, and that's what I've got. That's what I know infallibly that I have. So I'm out of trouble. With one bound, I am free from this whole epistemological nightmare, this kind of skeptical swamp, whereas you're still stuck in it. God provides me with that escape hatch. And that's a very interesting, it's an interesting thought. It is ultimately wrong, but it would be a very long conversation that we would now have to have in order to try and get to the bottom of exactly what's wrong with it. But
we don't have a whole hell of a lot of time left.
We'll
be moving on to closing here real soon. I would like to point out, as far as law, as not, sorry, I just mixed you up with Psi. That's my as far as Psi is concerned, argument kind of rests on the bedrock that human minds are fallible. That we who do not suppose that a God exists, we cannot know anything absolutely. In that sense, because it is generally accepted among theologians that God's omnipotence doesn't, it doesn't allow him to violate logic, for instance, because his existence is based on logic. His nature is that of logic. Therefore, it seems to me to be a bit of an issue for Psi to say, well, he can reveal things to me that my mind will know it infallibly. I don't think that is possible, because if you're already going to use the argument that we can't know anything infallibly because we have human minds, then a God, no matter how omnipotent, unless he's omnipotent to the level that he can just violate logic, which many theologians would not accept, Because if you do, then you can't use a logical argument to prove him because he doesn't pertain to logic. If you accept that our minds are fallible, and he accepts that his mind is fallible because he is a human just as much as we are, then it is not the case that a god could reveal himself in such a way that he could know absolutely to be true. That seems to be like a huge issue for him that he's never really addressed as far as I've ever seen.
Yeah, I just hadn't come across that particular thought before until Sai came up with it. And although most of what he says is drivel, I thought there was at least something kind of interesting in there that would be worth thinking through. Maybe I'll write something about it at some point. I think the right answer is the one that you've given, actually. I mean, God does not have that ability to give people that kind of infallible knowledge, actually. I think that's the right answer, but it would take a little bit of explaining as to exactly why I think that's true. So I'm not even going to start with that now.
All right, Zulu, do you want to go ahead and move on to closing since we only have about 4 minutes left?
Well, Stephen, just this kind of soapbox moment here, if there's anything you want to promote or anything, just go ahead.
Oh, right. I hadn't really thought about my soapbox moment. I wasn't aware I was going to be given one. Well, obviously, everyone should immediately rush out and purchase all of my books. But the books that I'm particularly keen on, actually, I'm particularly keen on getting philosophy and skeptical thinking out to kids. So I wrote a book called The Philosophy Files, which is now The Complete Philosophy Files, which is for children aged 12 and up. Go and buy that for any kid that you think might be vaguely interested that's already spontaneously asking those kind of philosophical questions. That would be my plug. And then a lot of other people would enjoy The Philosophy Gym, GYM, which published a few years ago, and I'm still pretty pleased with that one. Yeah. So that was entirely selfish, wasn't it? Go and buy my books. I didn't have anything more meaningful to say than just let's buy my merchandise. I mean, that's shameful, but that's the best I've got. Sorry.
That's kind of the point of the evening so far.
Okay.
I'm going to prove myself in a couple minutes. Feel free to pull a Hitchens, be like available and find bookstores everywhere. Feel free to do that.
Yeah, no, that's it. Those are the books that that I'm particularly pleased with, and also the Believe in Bullshit book, actually, which, you know, it worries me that, you know, my kids, because I've got pretty young kids, are going to walk down the street and some wide-eyed true believer is going to press a leaflet into their hand, and they're not going to have the intellectual defenses they're going to need, the immunity to snake oil that they're going to need, not to be sucked into some turgid, nutty thought world. And I think they're all... So I think it's important that all kids get some exposure to critical thinking, and that also that they get some awareness of what the warning signs are so far as weird and wacky belief systems are concerned. So that, you know, a little red light will come on in their head the next time some nutcase tries to suck them into their strange conspiracy theory or whatever it might happen to be. I think that's particularly important. So that would be my advert for Believing Bullshit and getting people to read Believing Bullshit. Because we're all vulnerable. No matter how smart and intelligent we think we are, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle believed in fairies, for goodness sake. And he invented Sherlock Holmes, who was the quintessentially rational fictional character. So we're all vulnerable. I've no doubt I believe quite a lot of bullshit. I just still haven't figured out which bits of what I believe are the bullshit, but I'm working on it.
All right, so you want to go ahead and close
then? Yeah. Everyone, thank you very, very much to our guest, Dr. Stephen Law. It's been fantastic. Thanks for taking the time out. Thank you to my co-host, Lundy, as always.
Always good to be here.
And Kitch.
Thanks for... No, sorry. Yeah. Hey, bye, guys.
Yeah. Go to bed.
Yes, go to bed.
Need some sleep. Exactly. Where I plan to go.
Yeah, and just to let everyone know, the show will be uploaded to iTunes and YouTube. Like I say, just keep an eye on my channel. The links are all down below. And we are back next week at our regular time. And our special guest is Albert Saber. Do you guys know who that is?
Does not ring a bell. Tell me what he does, I probably know.
He was the Egyptian atheist blogger that was put to prison for blasphemy last year.
Ah, yes, now I remember.
So that'll be a very interesting show just to get... He's now living in Hungary. He's managed to escape the blasphemy charges, so It'll be very interesting to hear his point of view of things in Egypt and just general, having spent time in prison for blasphemy.
Excellent.
All right, so thank you very much, everyone, for tuning in, and we'll see you all next week. Good night, everyone.
Good night.
Good night, everybody.